While we were hovering in the area of the east end of Goat Ridge in the Sea King helicopter, trying to get forward to the known concentration areas of our own wounded on Tumbledown Mountain, although we couldn't move forward, the helicopter felt unable to go further forward. Which was a great sadness to me at the time. We did light upon five seriously wounded Gurkha soldiers who were waiting for medical help. And it was very satisfying to be able to be of immediate assistance to these particular unfortunates and gather those in and take them to surgery with 16 field ambulance at Fitzroy. This was an antidote to some of the frustration one had felt during the rest of the night's business of not being able to get one's hand on the wounded. One felt at last one was doing some positive good, and it's certainly in my mind that those five men benefited from our arrival on the battlefield at that point at that time. One of these Gurkha soldiers had been pronounced dead by his companions on the ground, and one other of them was in a very bad state. When we actually got to Fitzroy and Captain Coombs, I think it is, from 16 Field Ambulance, certainly their adjutant, helped me unload these casualties. I indicated that one of them was thought to be dead, but when we had a closer inspection, he turned out to be very much alive and, in fact, survived. And so this was a very good feeling indeed to be able to intervene and do some actual positive good. The adjutant from 16 Field Ambulance, I thought, a remarkable man throughout the campaign, and did a lot to train his men and keep up morale and keep things moving during some very difficult times. And he was very much in evidence when I got to Fitzroy to deliver these Gurkha casualties. We went back with the Sea King to have another go at getting into Tumbledown Mountain to pick up the injured and wounded. But again, they felt unable to do so. And it wasn't until Captain Drennan from the Army Air Corps, who used to be in the Scots Guards, we met him as he dropped in at the RAP area, and we briefed him about the situation on Tumbledown, and he volunteered to fly forward to organise the picking up of the rest of the wounded, which he did. So they were able to get to surgery in time, which made one feel, and I've said this in my report, that the thing I've learned from this campaign as a medical officer with a frontline unit, and we were really the only unit who got into the real action of Five Brigade, is that you've simply got to have a regimental dedicated organic helicopter whose pilot is a member of the regiment in every sense of the word, who will move forward to the difficult and tricky positions to pick up the seriously injured wounded in time to get them back to surgery. It is no good waiting for an impersonal brigade organized service to do the same job. It simply doesn't work. You've got to have your own organic helicopter, and the pilot has really got to be a working member of the regiment to do any good. And there are lots of other tasks that the commander can give him as well, which will be useful. It is not true to say that, oh, there's not enough helicopters to go around. If you're the lead regiment in a brigade operation, you should get a helicopter as of right to do this sort of thing, unless you've got good roads and other transport facilities. I don't think I would ever agree to go into an operation like this again, saying that all was medically well, or even nearly well, unless I had this facility. The other thing I would say is that that all the military operations that one practices and all the exercises one goes into, commanders have really got to be taught how to use their medical facilities and their casualty evacuation chain in the same way as they make use of their mortars or their guns or their radios. They've got to be part of the game as it's played. Otherwise, they cannot possibly make use of the medical facilities to ensure that their men get proper evacuation and prompt treatment. it's very difficult to get people in the big army, as it were, to get involved in medical matters, but they've really got to be if they're going to be effective in both preventing and treating and evacuating casualties. Could we just pause there for a moment? In our RAP on that night of the 13th, 14th, we didn't stay stationary. At one point, we the Scots Guard section of the medical backup forward, leaving 16 Field Ambulance D section in the Goat Ridge area. We moved forward, just carrying medical packs, forward to tactical headquarters of 2nd Battalion Scots Guards, as they were at the end of Goat Ridge, facing Tumbledown Mountain during the height of the battle. We were called forward to deal with casualties which were making their way back, both walking wounded and the stretcher parties, which I mentioned before, were broken up by the terrain and climate and the fire. And we were there to meet them as they arrived back from the forward positions. Now, they got broken up, and in fact, we only met one chap who was wounded in the right upper arm, and three or four other walking wounded were lost in the snow and confusion at the time, and walked back past tactical headquarters to the RAP, where they were dealt with by D section and ourselves later. And the one or two stretcher-borne casualties took hours to get back to the RAP. Though when they did get there, all was well, and they were well cared for on the way, and they were comfortably kept, given morphine, and kept covered up, and all was well. It was the sheer physical difficulty of carrying a heavy stretcher all that way back over the rocky, marshy terrain in the dark and under gunfire that proved so difficult, even if you were able to get casualties away and out of the forward positions to a point where people could stand up and carry them. For much of the time, they were observed from enemy on higher ground looking down onto them with night equipment, so it was difficult to do that, to actually get at them and get them out and carry them. Well, in this forward position in tactical headquarters, we had a grandstand view of what was going on, and we could see the straight lines of heavy tracer, presumably from Rarden cannons or sustained fire GPMGs, firing from the Paran's positions to our left, i.e. to the north of us, as we faced Stanley with Tumbledown between us and Stanley. The tracer was sort of marking out the lines of Wireless Ridge, and then sort of its luminosity would fade out just before it got to Stanley. And there were rounds arriving from our own gunfire on our positions. Rounds even arrived in the night near the RAP, I mean near enough to throw mud and earth over the tents and trenches that we occupied. Rounds arrived near the tactical headquarters, and certainly they were arriving both from our own guns and the enemy's on Tumbledown Mountain ahead of us, which we could see plainly from time to time. Either the snow flurries cleared and the moon came out for a few seconds, or else it would be illuminated by the illuminating shells from our own guns or the enemy's, and also the explosions of the high explosive rounds that were falling on the mountain itself. And we could see the puffs going up in the forward positions where we knew our own men to be. It was quite a sight, this mountain, sticking up out of the mist and snow as it was in the half lights, illuminated from different angles. And the different arcs of tracers that were traced out around its crags. But eventually, things took on a different aspect as dawn appeared. And as I say, our own troops consolidated themselves the whole length of the Tumbledown feature and began to count the cost of the battle. Somewhere at this stage, at the casualty clearing up position, the enemy did begin to fall back from the mountain, and the ground immediately beyond it. And there we later on heard that the battle was possibly going to end, and this was confirmed later on. If things had gone on, we'd learnt a lot by this stage, and I'm sure we would have rolled on into Stanley. But in fact, the Scots Guards didn't follow the general melee of going down into Stanley to join in the celebrations there. They stayed and held fast as they were last ordered. They were told to take and hold Tumbledown Mountain. They weren't told to race on into Stanley and gather up booty or rejoice in any way. They obeyed their orders to a letter, and we stayed another night on the mountain before we relieved, and it was bitterly cold out there. My own section made use of a captured Argentinian tent to keep off the ice particles that were blowing around us. And we stayed there until we were evacuated to the sheep sheds at Fitzroy, where we recuperated and began to deal with other casualties that revealed themselves at this stage. We had lots of trench foot, which revealed itself. There had been a bit that appeared at Bluff Cove, and a little bit even on as far back as Intrepid, but very little. After the action on Tumbledown ended on the 14th, more and more cases of trench foot revealed themselves, both at Fitzroy. Much more, they revealed themselves 3 or 4 days later when we travelled by helicopter to the British Rail Ferry St Edmund, where we stayed, many of us stayed, less one company in fact that was on either the Baltic or the Nordic. We stayed until the end of June, when we left St Edmund to take up gas and duties on West Falkland Island in the northern part, centred around Port Howard and Hill Cove and Roy Cove. During that time, when we were waiting to go as garrison troops to West Falkland, many people suffered from minor or even major trench foot on St Edmund. Very few, in fact, had to be evacuated to the hospital ships, which by that time were full up with casualties anyway. We were able to sustain them and treat them ourselves on the rail ferry St Edmund. It's a very painful condition, trench foot, and there's very little you can do to relieve the pain. We did what we could. The main thing is rest and elevation, absolute rest and elevation of the parts. And it does all get better given time, and you've got to have patience and the opportunity to rest, which soldiers certainly had on board this British Rail ferry, where we were all able to catch up on our rest and on our eating that had fallen behind. Later on, during our time until we left Falkland Islands, we formed part of the garrison troops on West Falkland, as I say, and even provided, our own RAP provided a medical service for the civilians as well on the northern part of West Falkland prior to reorganisation of the civilian medical services. And we had no more casualties of a war nature to deal with, and happily no mine casualties either that did afflict some other units. We had the ordinary day-to-day illnesses that the battalion has, but much less. Everyone was so invigorated by surviving the experience of Tumbledown and being in action. There were no complaints. People didn't complain about things. Minor illnesses became so minor that they weren't worth mentioning to the doctor. And the medical staff weren't, fortunately, too busy during this time. Everyone, I think, was ennobled by surviving this experience and strengthened by it. And as always, as comes out of a situation like that, experiences were learnt, lessons were learnt. I learnt a lot about myself, everyone in the battalion did. We learnt a lot of lessons from the military and the medical point of view. And having survived, one would like to feel that any lessons that were learnt would benefit future operations, should there sadly have to be any. But I can't help feeling that you've simply got to have dedicated first aid training in a battalion, which is closely supervised by the medical officer, so that everyone in the battalion feels that he's able to dress and deal with the common battle wounds of the legs, the chest, the head and the abdomen, confidently do it, be put through the motions of doing so he knows exactly what to do. Know how to use morphia, know how to keep casualties warm and protected, make them comfortable. And above all, to have a casualty evacuation service, which is practiced by the battalion so that they can rely on it. And when all else fails, to have an organic medical evacuation helicopter to deal with the serious casualties to get them out at the first possible occasion when this occurs.
And did you come all the way back to England on the QE2?
Sadly not. We had hoped that we would, particularly our padre, booked his cabin to come back, and I shared a cabin with him, and I was all for doing this, and we did hope that they would pick us up and take us back, but it wasn't to be. We came back on a very friendly vessel that I got to like very much, called Norland, a large car ferry from one of the North Sea routes. And we came back in company with about 40 Falkland Islanders who were going to take a holiday in England following their experiences. And it was a very interesting time for me because we had a 10-day journey from Stanley to Ascension. And there was about 1,000 of us on board. And I was only, the only doctor on board. And it was a real deep-sea ship's medical officer experience that I was able to have for the first time. And with the support of the master, all went swimmingly well. Luck was on our side, and we had no serious incidents, although we had a few close calls. And it was very much a happy time for the battalion, coming back from the Falklands through all the fine weather again, out of the snow and ice, because we were leaving a Falklands winter behind us, to come to Ascension Island and pick up our VC-10 aircraft there that brought us back to a rapturous reception at Bryce Norton with our families.
Yes, it must have been good to be back, I should think.
Well, it certainly was, and a great cultural shock to come back to England after being immersed in the environment of the Falkland Islands. One was left with an absolute kaleidoscope of experiences and emotions as a result of that short time down there. Don't forget, we were only in action for 12 days. The journey was 3 months. Much of that was travelling through various climates. And quite a lot of it was spent in an extra winter that we didn't bargain for in the middle of our summer here in England, an extra winter on the Falkland Islands, particularly on the winter of West Falkland, that we spent at West Falkland Island. And then when we came back, we fortunately were able to get a bit of the end of the summer, only to be followed eventually by our third winter of the year when December came. That was going to be. It's rather unusual to get three winters in 1 year.
Alan, thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.